All right. How did your personal political activity change during the 30s? Did you continue just to do this, trying to organize small YCL branches in different cities, or did you move on to other things? Were there different priorities?
Well, I have to say one of the biggest events in my personal life that took place in the 30s was that the Communist Party and the Young Communist League leadership agreed to send me overseas to study and to travel, because I was very vocal and made good speeches, wrote nice articles, and was generally effective in whatever I did among the young people. When it came to the time to select people on various delegations to go places and so on, I was among the fortunate ones, which to a great extent solidified my convictions and my beliefs, because I had an opportunity to spend over a year in the Soviet Union, traveling all the way out to almost to the border of China and back, and all across the country, and then to go to different parts of Europe. And altogether, I spent 2 years, which was from 1933 to 1936, or part of the year, you know, giving me a total of 2 years of absence from this country.
Mm-hmm.
The best part of my time I spent studying. When I came back, I remember I had my 25th birthday on Lake Baikal. That's way out by the Taiga in Asiatic Russia. We had a big celebration, I was with a group of other young people. And so when I returned to this country, like in the early 36, I felt like I was pretty much on my own as an organizer. And the party then decided to send me to Gary, Indiana, as the full-time organizer. It's a man's industry, man's town, and a whole new set of problems developed as I came in again as an assistant to the organizer of the Communist Party. But shortly after that, the organizer himself left Gary for other places, and I was left in charge, and I remained in Gary for 4 years during the entire period of the organization of the Steelworkers Union.
Oh, exciting.
Yes, it was one of the most exciting periods of our American trade union life, because the unions were coming in large numbers, and the experience there consisted essentially in the mobilizing of the Communist Party and the Young Communist League forces for the organization of the Steelworkers Organizing Committee, which became the Steelworkers Union.
What was your strategy?
Well, our main strategy was to definitely assist the masses of people to make up their mind to join on a large scale. A good example of that perhaps would be to show the influence of the party in that one steel community. And it's surrounded by steel and oil, like Whiting, Indiana, is oil. Hammond, Indiana had the Queen Mary Candy Company, which factory which we helped to organize into another union. And it's called the Calumet Steel Area. And the Steelworkers Organizing Committee knew that if they were to get the union really on the map, they had to get the Communist Party to work with them.
So you worked for them as open communists?
I worked as an open communist, but not with them or against them. I worked for the Communist Party and openly wrote articles in the local papers, issued leaflets. And at one time, they were people who came in from the outside, the John L. Lewis forces. Pompakia was one man, and other names will come back. They went into the big mill, which had some 20,000 workers, and couldn't budge, couldn't get cards signed. But when they gave me hundreds of application cards, and I gave it to my group of comrades, inside the mail. They swept through all the departments and they came back with hundreds of signed cards. Then the union leaders realized that this is the force that you have to contend with in order to get the union set up in the Gary Steele mill. And so,
what could they do that John L. Lewis couldn't do?
Well, they were inside the mill. The workers trusted them. The workers had led, our comrades had led all kinds of little struggles and fights for years. Some of them were even remembered from way back of the 1919 big steel strike that William Z. Forster had led in 1919, and this was maybe 20.
Were they known as communists in the mills, or did they have to keep that a secret?
No, I think it was a very secret nature, because while one or two might have been known, they had lived all their life. I remember there was one family with grandfather and father, and the two sons were in the mill. They were so deeply rooted, both in the plant and in the community, that the company wouldn't bother with them because they didn't want a mess on their hands. And so around these people, we had built a very important organization, and we gave out monthly bulletins. We used to issue 5,000 copies every month and discuss all of these issues and organize the union so that these and these conditions could change and so on. And we were a major factor. We were especially important in the mobilizing support from the black people for unionism and from white people towards the black people to shed the deep hostilities and prejudices to the people. So it came to a point where these organizing forces asked me to work for them. Mm-hmm. I consulted the Communist Party leadership in Chicago, which was our headquarters, and we decided if I'm good enough for them, then I'm good enough for the party. Meaning if, but of course, here I live on $8 a week and I have to eat in the Gary Cooperative restaurant to get my food free. Whereas here I would be on a payroll with clothes, with a car, even though they were not of the same type of bureaucracy that you find now in the unions, but by comparison to the way the communists lived, these organizers, they had money for leaflets and for rides. I still had to hitchhike, although later I acquired a little Model T Ford, and I was able to drive all around the area in my little Ford, you know. And we turned them down, and we told them that I will not accept, but I will cooperate at any level possible. And so, in many ways, I was like on the staff, only I didn't get paid and I didn't go to their meetings.
Well, I guess one thing I'm curious about is I've always felt conscious that since the 50s, since the McCarthy era, it's been impossible for one to just, you know, work at a place and announce that one is a socialist. It's
That's a very, very tricky
question. And sometimes someone can be in a place for years and years and never actually come right out and say they are a member of a cadre organization. And what I'm wondering is, during the 30s, was it easier to be a socialist? Was there more acceptance that people wouldn't go and run off in the other direction? Or did you have to be very, was it also a very, you know, touchy question then, too?
Well, I think I would again divide it into two categories. I would say that those who were unemployed, and there were 16 million unemployed, in a workforce that was
in the United States.
In the United States, mm-hmm. 60 million. I was a, before I went to Gary, I was a leader of the unemployed. We were leading, I was, before that I was in Buffalo.
Mm-hmm. So,
and the unemployed, the communists among the unemployed, spoke freely, many of them, about their communist affiliation. The primary reason being that it was very important to establish the fact that we were great adherents of the Soviet Union, of the socialist motherland. And this probably might have been one of the big reasons for the later errors and suffering of the Communist Party, because it was an allegiance to the Soviet Union, which was in many areas a blind allegiance, while the respect for the tremendous contributions made to all of humanity by a people who first throw off the shackles of capitalism is unquestioned. But when we closed our eyes to many things that were going on in the Soviet Union, such as the famous trials in the 36 and the persecutions of the people within the party and so on, and others writing about it as part of their anti-Soviet propaganda, and we, the American communists, rejecting that as propaganda instead of looking into the developments in the Soviet Union, we therefore isolated ourselves, or we did not get the kind of following for a socialist America as we could have. But to answer your question, during that period, we called meetings in the name of the Communist Party, or at the Unemployed Council's called meetings. They would invite Ethel Stevens, that was me, the communist organizer of the community, to come and speak, which was acceptable. And we would come out with our Communist Daily World, our newspaper, and sell it on the picket lines or sell it in the demonstrations, and that was acceptable. In other words, we were part of the mainstream, especially of the unemployed and of those who we were trying to organize. But then there was a group within industry that remained in industry that wasn't unemployed. And among them we had communists, and they had to work in illegal circumstances. They had to get out their newspapers and magazines and leaflets in secret and distribute them secretly. Only on rare occasion could they identify themselves. And they built the Communist Party and Young Communist League organization as they built the union, but separately, secretly, and so on.
How were you able to get so accepted by the Steelworkers Union then, if you were an open communist?
Well, it was obvious what was true in Gary, I think, was true in other steel areas or the stockyards communities or other basic industries. The Communist Party and the Young Communist League for decades, possibly two decades, since 1919, 1929, now we're in the middle of the 30s. Mm-hmm. For almost two decades, I wrote and spoke about the need to have industrial unions, to try to do away with the craft unions, to organize on a mass scale. And we were the only consistent force that agitated and worked for that line. When you asked me before what was your strategy, that was our strategy from the very birth of the party, organize into big mass unions. Organize into other organizations like auxiliaries, women's auxiliaries around the unions to help the people. And so the people knew who was doing it. There were some people who were working openly as Communist Party leaders because we had Communist Party offices that were open. We would issue material, we would give the addresses and telephone numbers. And so these people were openly accepted. I was among them. I couldn't walk in Gary a block without somebody greeting me or saying, how are you, Ethel? How is it going? And so on. Because they had seen me on street corner meetings. They had heard me speak in their mass organization, the fraternal orders. They saw me in front of the mill giving out Communist Party leaflets. And so when organizing the steel workers on a large scale into the trade unions was on the agenda of the day. We were very much part of it. In fact, the workers wouldn't move on a large scale until they cleared it with us.
Was Stevens your party name?
Yes, Red Stevens. I had verified
Red Stevens,
there.
What a name.
Yeah, Red Stevens. I had several names, but that name I kept the longest during that organizing period.
Were you one of the only women involved in that, or were there still
in the Gary situation, wives? During that period, directly working for the Communist Party, I was the only one. But we had communists working with the Steel Workers Organizing Committee, and the top leadership knew that they were communists, and they hired them because they were communists, because they had the respect of the workers. And then we had some women who were party members who worked with the auxiliaries of the steelworkers.
Were they militant too?
Oh, yes. They were the ones who came out during the strike or a stoppage or any protest. They were the ones who were on the picket lines, so they would bring the food, or they would guard an open gate through which the scabs might come through. The women were extremely brave in support of their husbands, even though it was at a very beginning level of consciousness on the part of the women. You know, they still wouldn't permit a woman to smoke in their presence, because she was taboo.
Uh-huh.
And here I was, a chain smoker, going from tavern to collect the juice of the party people, but they knew I wasn't a drinker.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew that I was very honest. I accounted for every penny that came in. Either I would give them the juice stamps in account. And so there was no question of not trusting us, because individually, we really had a beautiful party type of a person who was dedicated, clean. You see, what happened in later years is they became fanatics, including myself, where we had our eyes closed to all criticism from the outside, to the Soviet Union, to communism, and so on. We closed ourselves up, but that's another period, another epoch, which led to the breakup of the Comintern, you know, in 48. And so.
What did you think of John Lewis's comments after the steelworkers were organized? He said, "Well, yeah, we used the communists to organize them, and now that we organized them, I kicked them out."
Well, you see, we were prepared for that because we used John L. Lewis also for purposes of spreading Marxism among the steelworkers. It worked both ways, but we used them in a real broad, genuine sense of bringing socialist ideology to the people. And we knew the only way we could do it is by being with the workers. You can't stand on the outside and just through leaflets teach Marxism. You got to be in the struggle, mm-hmm. and show that you are the best organizer of a picket line, you know how to get a kitchen going, and you know how to make the best leaflet in answer to the scabs and all this. When we were accepted, and we knew that there may come a time when there would be a break of this kind of collaboration,
mm-hmm.
because John L. Lewis was quite a reactionary. He was a Republican later, and in general was not, in my opinion, an advanced type of a thinker, you see. But he made a good name for himself because of his fight in the coal mining industry and organizing them against the real adverse conditions, and at one time fighting under dangerous circumstances, but he revealed corruption at different periods and so on. So we're never shocked at these things because we were hardened fighters. You see, you've got to remember we went through a tremendous crisis, this depression, an economic crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And we were the leaders, the mass leaders all over the country in all of these tremendous movements, together with others. But we were the main basic force that organized and led and gave direction. And so we became skilled in the art of talking, writing, leading, and so on.
So what made you leave Gary after 4 years?
What happened then is a personal, not so much personal, it was a political, but a peculiarity that forced me out of Gary. I was arrested something like 25 or 26 times by the time 1940 rolled around, after the organizing drive mm-hmm. was consolidated and all. And then the American government went after the foreign-born people on a large scale. And because of my very large record of arrests, the government refused to give me citizenship. And to this day, I'm not a citizen, and I had a deportation order hanging over my head,
mm-hmm.
which this next month we're going to have a hearing for the fourth time to see if we can squash it and give me an opportunity to become a citizen. I wanted to become a citizen then, and I want now to become a citizen. So what happened in 39 and 40, a war was developing on a world scale. Hitler invaded Poland on September 1st, 1939. And here I'm the organizer in Gary at that time. And the anti-alien laws are beginning to become solidified on the books of the United States statutes. And so the party advised all party people to become citizens. If they are not citizens, they would have to leave the party in order not to jeopardize the standing of the communist... Well, there weren't too many. Not to jeopardize the standing of the Communist Party in relation to the struggle that the party aimed to conduct against the war.
Mm-hmm.
I was on among that group of people who was told to leave the party.
Mm-hmm.
And however, while I was told to leave the party, we at the same time made arrangements for me to go into hiding. And in order to go into hiding, I had to get out of Gary, because I knew then, as we all did, that things would blow over and I would be able to come out into the open again. But in the meantime, I was not to be a hindrance to the party to establish its right to work against the war as a legitimate American organization.
The Communist Party was anti-war, period, at this
yes.
point.
Yes, anti-Hitler, anti-war, until they attacked the Soviet Union, and when they attacked the Soviet Union in June of 20.
Then you became a supporter of the Allies.
But yes, but that's an entirely different chapter.
Right.
I got to get back to
okay.
the other. I then left and went to different parts of the country and was in hiding and managed to get odd jobs, you know, waitress and domestic work and working in a restaurant.
Was you all by yourself?
I went to one place where I had relatives, so they knew where I was. So that wasn't difficult. The difficult period came during the McCarthy era, when I was in hiding from 1951 to 56. That was the period I'd written up in one of my books. I mean, I wrote a whole book on that. It's called The Storm Unleashed. That's another book.
Mm-hmm.
That's not so. It's the mind works peculiarly. When the storm broke,
mm-hmm.
I described the underground. It's a novel, but I describe it. So after a while, I went to New York. In New York, I got a job with the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers in their offices. I was a highly skilled office worker from the 20s yet, but I never used my skills, so I used my skills in that capacity, and they suggested I should go to a factory, to a metal shop, and go to work there, and after working a while, they could take me out as one of their organizers, because their policy was, that's known as the UE for short, the United Electrical Radio Machine Workers, their policy was to have organizers on their staff who had been in their shops, who came out from the ranks of the workers. So I worked for a number of months in the Johnson Machine Shop, learned how to blueprints and sharpen toolpicks and handle a small lathe. And then they...
What year was this?
That was 40 or 41.
And was this mostly women working in this?
No,
shop?
But you see, they were already beginning to mobilize men for the war, and the shops were beginning to empty out, and women were more acceptable, not so good yet. So I had plenty of problems, such as finding rotten tomatoes on my machine, or men tripping me, or deliberately rolling dice in front of my machine, so I couldn't step over. This went on and on in all the shops. But we broke through that shitty situation that was felt on the backs of the women.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were breaking into the industries, breaking up the prejudices. And I happened to have been very, very fortunate. An old man, a British tool and die maker, took a great liking to my hands and wanted me to help him handle his work. And he taught me tool and die making for the few months and taught me how to read blueprints and was protecting me. An old gentleman who was... very helpful, and so I developed some very fine skills
mm-hmm.
and got some promotions. And so on that basis, the union was able to take me out from the shop and make me an organizer. So I was 4 years on the organizing staff of the United Electrical Radio Machine Workers all during the Second World War.
And you were totally without contact with the Communist Party?
Oh, no. I was an activist in the Communist Party even during the days when we weren't supposed to have communists in it. I remained in the Communist Party. I never left the party. I was just working illegally until 1941. By illegal, I meant I laid low. I didn't appear in mass meetings. I didn't go to places where I would be noticed. But I was attending meetings. And I wasn't the only one. There were many people who refused to leave the party, even though we got an order.
So you were very outspoken and visible in the UE, but you laid low as far as
before
big CP events.
Well, no. I before that period.
Mm-hmm.
But things eased up when the war started. The pressures on the Communist Party were removed, you know.
I see.
Yeah, and it was not difficult, although we didn't work openly as communists. We had 14 communists on the staff of the UE. You know.
Uh-huh.
Well, 12 out of 14 were communists. The staff was 14. So I remained there for a communist all through the period until 1974 when the Communist Party expelled me.
Mm-hmm.
I remained an active Communist Party member until 1974.
So how long were you in hiding before the war started?
I think it was just about a year or a year and a half.
So when you returned to New York was sort of your...
When I came to New York, I decided I would, again, be at the disposal of the Communist Party. And they said, well, I remember I worked in a pocketbook factory, and then the boss asked me, do you know how to make out a bill? I said, yes, and he discovered I had skills in the office. So he put me to work in the office, took me out of the factory. So I stayed there a lot. Then I went to work for some millinery guy in an office. And so I whiled away time until the UE felt comfortable in taking me into their office. So I was underground maybe a year, maybe a year and a half. It's hard to pinpoint that. And then I worked openly on the staff, but I was not an organizer of the kind that goes to factories and organizes workers.
Mm.
I was put in charge of establishing a social service department of the UE.
Oh, how exciting.
It was a very exciting moment because I was able to get $10,000 at that time from the city budget for the opening up of our social service agency of the UE.
What kind of services did you offer?
Well, those services were really part of the war effort. People were fainting. People were getting nervous breakdowns because they were working 72 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
People had to hardly ever see their families, and the families were coming and complaining. During the beginning of the war, the invasion of the Soviet Union, beginning with 1941, and the war, don't forget, was going on since 1939,
mm-hmm.
but we got into it on December the 7th of 1941 when Pearl Harbor was attacked.
Mm-hmm.
So from that moment on, the war effort of the unions was very important, and I became notorious, you could call it, for giving blood. I gave 16 pints of blood, but with it, I pulled the factories that went with me, and we sold war bonds. But my big contribution was that I worked together with a Father McDonald in the community and the Jewish Community Service and others. We built some kind of a united front among all of us to relieve the great pressures upon the workers in the shops who were working under very adverse conditions. And we were essentially really a referral agency, you would call it. We did have two social workers and myself working in the union office. We had a place set up there.
So you were like psychological services?
Sort of. People with real serious family problems, personal problems. You see, people would leave the plant and we wanted them to stay in the plants. We wanted production to continue. We were the patriots during the war, there's no question.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent 4 years in that capacity, but on many occasions I would go on the picket line, or when they went to visit a shop, I would go, I would make a speech about our department, think that they should refer bad cases to us, that we are able to help. We helped a lot of people.
What kind of problems can you think of?
Yes, I can think of a man that works in the UW Bliss plant. The UW Bliss plant in Brooklyn was making, what do you call it, not the bullets, but the things that the boats use for...
Don't ask me.
You would know if I mentioned it. Well, they were producing the war ammunition for the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And because the industry wasn't too expanded yet and all this, you know, you needed the people to stay in the job. So I remember one man who passed out after 72 hours work.
Straight?
No.
Oh.
No, that week. Mm-hmm. He worked 72 hours, but he had no rest. It meant, mm-hmm. you know, he was working 7 days, 12 hours a day. 10 hours a day. See what
was it required overtime?
Well, it was almost. A lot of them had to do it in order to keep the war industry fed, moving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're in a war, you know. And some of them were patriotic, and some of them felt this is the chance to buy their home and
mm-hmm.
send the boy to college and so on. And the man collapses and goes berserk. There's no provisions, no protection for the family. They lose everything. So we have to get them into some charitable status so that they would be eligible for that, and we have to find a place to send the man away to recoup. Right? To find out that he has to go to a mental hospital and stay there. You've got to make sure that in the mental hospital they don't beat the hell out of him, but that he instead recovers. So you keep tab on that. You keep tab on the family. And eventually you bring them back together and the man can go back to work.
Did you see a lot of women working in the UE at this time?
Well, yeah. When I worked myself, you know, I was one of those few put on slacks, which wasn't worn at that time. And I had my little lunch bag, you know, the
mm-hmm.
metal bag, going with my tools to work. And you see others carry the toilet, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You see them on the subways and in the elevators. We were getting into the production field. There was a discrimination of a different kind. We were doing the bad work. Promotions were slow and all that. But at least the doors were open for women to get into industry.
Did you do anything else as part of the war effort that was more of an injury? Besides the social services, you say you gave blood. Did you... and you sold war bonds. Did you have victory gardens or, I mean, did you do it?
Well, others did
aluminum
it.
Drives or...
Well, others did it. I couldn't do any more than 24, then what you can put it in 24 hours, and I worked 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I worked in our union offices. We had staff meetings. We had to go to factories. We had to go on parades. We had to make speeches for the war bond. We had to mobilize. I remember at one time I mobilized something like 18 shops to go and get blood.
Mm-hmm.
That was part of my work. You see, to go to the shops, line them up, deal with the Red Cross, and they, you know, schedule the appearances of this shop to hook up with that shop. Well, then you got a lot, about 6-8 hours for rest and sleep. That's about all we did. So there are other activities, of course, by other courses, but I'm listing the activities of one who was in a union staff for 4 years, working in that direction. That was very serious, intense type of activity.
Now, how old are you at this time?
Well, we can figure out. Let's assume I was born 1910, although it's 1909,
mm-hmm.
but it's easier to figure, and this is 1940, so I'm 31 years of age.
What was your relationship with your family at this time?
Well, that's an interesting question, very interesting, because you might remember from my previous description, we have an unusual family of beautiful people. My old parents lived in Chicago.
They stayed on in the same place
on Bell Street. And I was away from them for so many years, but I used to send a little bit of money to them from my earnings on the staff of the UE.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would make trips to Chicago to visit the family. And when I'd come, my mother once took out $300. She said, "We didn't lose any of your money. Here it is, buy yourself a winter coat." Well, I refused because I had enough clothes then. Mm-hmm. At that time, it wasn't like in the 30s, you know. We were already on the staff. I was getting a regular salary.
Was your father still making cigars?
Yes, all his life.
I was something I forgot to ask you last time was, did people come to his house and buy the cigars from him, or did he make them and then peddle them on the street?
Well, it wasn't peddling on the street or that way. There were one or two people who would come and buy one or two boxes of cigars. Or my brother would take one or two boxes to somebody he knew. You know, these were very good cigars. They were hand-rolled and made of the best tobacco. And if you make yourself two, three boxes a day, you've had it. You've done a good job.
Mm-hmm.
But then my father lined up several what you would call at that time delicatessen stores, you know, dairy stores,
mm-hmm.
and candy stores that carried good quality cigars. And he would take an order, and he would say, okay, next week I'll bring you a box and this one. So he would take walks and carry his two, three boxes of cigars. That was the nature of the distribution, but of course there was problems of buying the tobacco and keeping it in good shape. And we worked for molds, you know, you roll the raw leaves and the crumbly mm-hmm. parts into a better leaf and you put it in a mold. And the molds had 10. A mold was like a cutout.
You know,
you put it in and then you put another mold over it and that presses it down. You would have a little press. And that shapes them into the size you want them. And then you put a final good leaf over it. And that was the thing I did and my mother did. We would strip the very expensive fine outer leaf and then he would roll it neatly, nicely, and then we would put a label on it and so on. So my father, my mother, and I, whenever I would come home, I would like to indulge a little bit, you know. Yeah. Now my parents thought that I and my other sister, the only two communists in the family, were God's gift on earth because of our dedication and our loyalties to the movement. And
your sister was still in the party in the 40s, too?
She's in the party now. She's a full-time worker in the party.
Oh.
I'm the only one who was expelled. You know, I'm an Angela. She voted for my expulsion. She's a real... We try to maintain any friendly relations, which we do, but it's a very limited kind of a subject all by itself.
Mm-hmm.
We were the only, so, but at that time, we were very dedicated. She and I would arrange to meet someplace. And our parents, they were just beautiful in the sense that they had great, deep appreciation for what we did, as we showed deep respect for their religious thinking. Mm-hmm. We would never mock it. They were traditional rituals, you know, the benching the lift, you know, the blessing of the candles that my mother had every Friday. My father's going for the minyan in the synagogue. And so, mm-hmm. so there was a very deep understanding and tolerance that's due to each other. And as a result of that, we developed a very good love to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't hurt each other. For instance, when I was away in Europe in the Soviet Union, it was very important to keep quiet. It was a secret.
Mm-hmm.
My parents were able to keep it a secret. And I would write to them, and occasionally they would enclose a dollar bill in the Depression. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody, they wouldn't tell anyone where we were. You know. And I remember when I came back from the Soviet Union, I was sitting in jail at Sunders for a little while on North Avenue. And my father wanted to come and visit me, but he didn't know what a jail is like, how you go and really. He was a religious Jew, he didn't beard, you know, mm-hmm. they don't have long kapot. And they had to learn how to visit me in jail and great tolerance. I described that scene in jail in one of my books.
Did you ever have to? Were you ever sentenced?
I served a sentence that was near Buffalo, in Tonawanda, North Tonawanda, New York. We had a huge demonstration of the unemployed, and we went to the unemployed council. We went to the city council to demand free milk for the children. There was a shortage of milk. There was a shortage of money. The parents couldn't buy the milk. that was our big demand to get prenup to the children, so we were able to get all the parents with infants. And we came with other demands, of course. And the North Adelanda City Council had surrounded the whole big room that was able to hold about 300 people with men who had billies and blackjacks and guns, and they broke it up, beating us all. I jumped on the table and made a big speech, but the leader, the two men leaders, were wounded, their skulls were open. They got a year jail, I got 3 months, I and another woman, because we were women, and this became a big national thing, because a very important event. They gave us 3 months in the Monroe County Penitentiary Jail. That's where I served. That's the only sentence I served at that length. I served other sentences of 2 weeks, a month, because the total number of arrests added up to 29.
Mm-hmm. What would you do in jail, since you had, you know, just time?
I had one hell of a good time. That was when I put on 9 pounds on my weight. I happened to be in the Monroe County Penitentiary with the women. They had only 40 women. Mm-hmm. The men were in, they had thousands, I think, or hundreds of men. Mm-hmm. So they were eating from the general kitchen, but we were eating from the officer's kitchen. We had beautiful food. And this girl and I, we were highly respected because we weren't like the other prostitutes or thieves or women or murderers, you know. So we were treated very good. And we were working in the sewing room. And I always had a liking for sewing and aptitude, so I would show others how to thread the machine and fix the bobbin. So life in that particular jail was very good for me. In fact, I got into a lot of trouble because I said so to an interviewer, a newspaper, while our men were having one hell of a time on the other side of the building.
Mm-hmm.
They were having a very rough time. We were having a gala time.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I would have wished to go to jail for 3 months, but as long as I was there, we took advantage of everything. And my main thing that I did there was I read through all the works by Nikolai Lem.
Oh, wow.
I got a complete library taken in. I was allowed. And every minute I had, I, as you know from my previous comments, I was so hungry for knowledge and all that. I studied everything. Those 3 months were very good months.
Well spent.
Very well spent. I remember when I came out, the first thing I wanted was a cigarette. I took a cigarette and I passed out.
You hadn't had a cigarette in 3 months?
Didn't have it, no. It was a fire hazard there. The women were smoking in their private place, but, you know, we had to observe the rules and be good, you know. After all, we represent the communists, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we behaved. I mean, we would behave.
Well, it must have been hard for you to quit at that time, if you'd been a chain smoker.
I'm trying to remember. Yes, I had already been a chain smoker because I became a smoker in 29 in Milwaukee. Yeah. And this was about in the 30s. But still, you're young and, you know, you have all kinds of dreams. You represent the glory of the CP. You gotta behave. But when I came out, I asked for a cigarette and someone gave me one. They're deep inhalation. I just either fainted or something. I know they revived me right away. Then they said, what do you want to eat? I said, just give me a piece of black bread and butter and rub some garlic around it.
To me, that was a dream for 3 months. When I was asking you about your family, I was interested. Did you ever do work with your other sister in the CP? Were you up in the same branch, or were you always
not
doing separate activities?
Not after we left the Young Communist League. We were in the same branch of the Young Communist League when I first joined, which must have been in 1924, maybe 25, about that time, yeah. And my sister belonged to that branch. And then after a while, she met this very handsome fellow, and they got married, and they went away. They were traveling as organizers, and I remained there, and then later I left the branch, and we had never since been together.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm just about out of time.